Hello and welcome to Intrepid Heroes Presents, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products, such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Jason Keeley. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me, John.
So Jason is a developer for Paizo, having previously worked as an editor both at Paizo and at Any Winning Pantheon Press.
Yes.
So I guess that was a little while ago?
That was a bit ago. That's actually a company that I helped start and put out a couple books. And I only kind of recently decided to sort of shut the doors on that because the three of us are now living in three different states. and me working full-time here at Paizo made it really difficult for other people do it. Other people have their third-party products, but it was didn't have enough time to get to do stuff with that at the time. I might bring some of that stuff back in the future, but we can always talk about that later.
Yeah, and I'm kind of curious, what type of things were you doing at that as a publisher there?
That was role playing game stuff. Okay. We started with a D20 setting with an adventure that I wrote and some new extra rules. We did it at exactly the right time, and by right time I mean exactly the wrong time. It was when Wizards was moving towards 4th edition, Pathfinder was just getting started, right, as its own entity. And we decided, we wrote it for 3.5, basically, and then, like, a month later had to put out a fax saying, like, yeah, hey, you want to run this for Pathfinder, change, you know, remove the swim skill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we did that. We put out a couple books for that, a couple physical things. It was a move forward in the setting of like timeline. It was a little more Renaissance focused than most fantasy sort of medieval focused. So we had early firearms and we had cool fencing. We had social constructs kind of rule. You can get a patron and stuff like that. I wrote an adventure that was about a thinly veiled William Shakespeare, trying to be murdered. So it had a lot to do with the theater because. I have a bit of a theater background. Then we put out like sort of our own sort of bestiary, but it was mostly just sort of NPC codex kind of situation. That was a PDF only. And then we moved on to a different, entirely different kind of game. It's a tarot-based role-playing game that won us our Any.
So when you say tarot card
tarot based? Cards were the resolution mechanic.
Right.
And a lot of other tarot card games out there can be sort of like interpretive, and we went with more mechanical rules. Right? Basically, you build a character up in a sort of a life path kind of system, choosing whether or not what. Yeah, this was also a Renaissance-based situation. It was the Renaissance of the real world, but with fantasy elements. So there were dwarves and elves and orcs and whatnot. You pick how old you are and how tall you are and that sort of thing, your background and that, and then you got your stats, and then you like some cards were really lucky for you and some were not, so that's how you got critical successes and critical failures, but mostly you sort of like had a number based around your stats and whatnot, and you turn a card and it would say, oh, is this minor arcana greater than or less than your number is, and then you succeed or not. And there were degrees of success, and then you could the fun thing was is that the GM never touched the deck, so it was all your players were drawing for defense and attack and all that, but you could also, the players could manipulate the deck. I'm like, oh, I know that this card's very, very lucky for me. I'm going to put it in the top three. Spend a point, and you had like so many points per session. Sometimes though, it didn't work for you, but that card might be very unlucky for your friend, and they might have to draw the next attack or defense. So it was a pretty good sort of like stacking the deck kind of mechanism that I'm pretty proud of, and that's the sort of thing that if I had an infinite amount of time, I'd sort of adjust that the setting there and maybe bring it back. I had plans to sort of turn it into also like here's this game about pirates now instead of being just about medieval.
Right, it could be anything.
Right,
that's just the resolution system.
Yeah, exactly.
So it could have been any game.
Yeah, we had when we were creating that, and this is getting a bit into the weeds, but when we were creating that, we were started at a place where it was modern day. Modern fantasy, urban fantasy, angels and devils and whatnot, and we just couldn't make that setting work. So we was like, let's just do something very, very familiar: elves and dwarves and fantasy and magic and whatnot, and Renaissance. People basically know the Renaissance. You know, the sort of it was a generic European Renaissance, right. Basically, you know, because when we said, you know, the timeline here is as fluid as you need it to be. If you need Galileo and Shakespeare to be in the same adventure, go for it. Yeah. And I ended up running, we'd ran out of Gen Con a bunch mm-hmm. of times, taking sort of fairy tales and popular sort of myths like Elizabeth Bathory and sort of giving them our own treatment. I had some fans. I still get some people coming to me at Gen Con or even PaizoCon saying, "Oh, I'm still playing that." I'm like, "Oh, it's great. I'm not selling it anymore." Sorry. Oh, we eventually did also a full campaign, sort of almost like an adventure path style mm-hmm. adventure in a single book about Jacob Grimm and how creating mm-hmm. fairy. So there's things happening, and like, oh no, you fight a big spider, and because Miss Muffet runs away, or you know the three bears. Oh my God. We ended up playing it through, sort of test it. The three bears were a real rough encounter. Yeah.
Well, neat. Well, so yeah. How did you get from doing that to your current position here at Paizo?
I mean, that's basically how I got started in the industry. I was working at editing crossword puzzles and other puzzles and that sort of thing in New York City, and a friend of ours said, "Let's put some money together. Let's start a company. Let's get LLC. Get all businessy about it." And so we did that, and we started that, and that was just sort of like had that as my resume for when I decided to try to break into the full time business. I just sort of started looking around. I'd done a little bit of other freelance at that point. Here and there, and I submitted to Wayfinder. I was in the RPG Superstar at the same time, and just saw that they needed editors and developers around about 5 years ago, and just put my name out there, put my resume out there, show them here we go. I was trying in a bunch of other different companies too, but it eventually ended up being I'd move all the way out here to Seattle from New York City.
Now, you had some credits already mm-hmm. with Paizo before you did that, though.
Yes and no. So my first attempt to get a job here was sort of like an editing position that mm-hmm. was very temporary, so they didn't want to have me move out for like a 6 month thing. Mm-hmm. But at that time, then I was like, they were like, do some freelance. So I started doing some freelance there. I did some freelance editing, and I wrote a couple small articles for like a player companion. Mm-hmm. And then, 9 months later, basically, I was hired.
I see. Seems like there's a lot of internal hires like that for
yes.
various positions here. Yeah. And is it familiarity with the product, familiarity with the people, or
it's both? Basically, we know that. I mean, once we need to fill a position, we sort of start by putting it out there to we put it out to the world, but we also sort of like nudge our favorite freelancers and be like, maybe you want to apply to this. Yeah. How you doing? And and that's basically how we got Ron and Dean and Luis Loza and Eleanor Farron, just basically saying like, you do great work on a part-time basis for us, why not come work full-time? Do you want to move out to Seattle?
Yeah, and that for some folks, this is an expensive area, so that could be a tough ask.
It is. It is a tough ask.
New York, Chicago, here it's probably not that big of a deal.
It's about comparable from where I was living in New York City. Mm-hmm. It's maybe a little cheaper in general. And you could have a car out here.
Right.
You really can't. I mean, it's way more expensive to have a car out in New York City. Way more of a pain in the butt to do that.
Oh yeah, just the parking and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So we bought a car to drive it from New York City here to Seattle, and still have it.
Nice. So can you tell us a little bit about your job as a developer, kind of what it entails, and mm-hmm. how that relates to the jobs of designers and of the various authors?
Sure. As a developer, I currently work on the Adventure Path line a lot. And the way I see that, I sort of liken that a little bit to a director in a film. And this metaphor will break down immediately. So What we do for Adventure Paths is that we get together and we come up with what we want it to be about. Mm-hmm. The sort of general themes, the overarching plot, how do we get from point A to point B. We hash that out over a series of meetings. As if I'm the lead of that particular path, I'll write up an outline that sort of gets into the nitty-gritty, into each of the specific adventures. Some places might have sort of holes in them that are will be for the author to fill. And then I seek out my freelancers and my authors, get them to basically, here's, you know, give them that and say, here we go. Here, you write this many words. It should start here. It should end here. It should, you know, be this level and whatever. And authors are basically given, they're the screenwriters. They're given that sort of freedom to write within those constraints. And then it comes back to me, and developing is kind of developmental editing, basically. I edit for clarity of story. I edit for rule stuff. Make sure that when I'm getting six adventures in, right, that they all sort of connect together. Mm-hmm. And if there's any sort of NPC name that's in part one that needs to be in part four, that's the same name. So continuity is big. Any place that sort of just needs some smoothing out, I will smooth that out. In terms of, that's basically what we do. We just sort of take the text, make it even better, where we can, and, where it's not already great, I mean, and pass that on to sort of editing. See, designers kind of, work with a little bit more. Well, developers, we have to know the rules and have to know how they interact with story. Designers kind of work from a just rulesy kind of standpoint. Mm-hmm. They make sure that they create that rule set from the base up, right? They're the ones who basically are there to give us the gears of the system and make sure they all turn and don't grind against one another so that developers can do our stories there, you know, make sure the setting. Developers also work on, you know, setting line books and that sort of thing. And they make sure that this, you know, area of the world or galaxy in line with what we've said before about it and how we want to present it, make sure we don't have any problematic issues, that sort of thing.
So in terms of, say, an adventure path, say you're introducing new creatures or in Starfinder new starships and things like that, do the designers help spec those out, or do they verify what the authors do, or is that something you do?
That's generally what I do. The designers have, at this point, basically have given us all those tools to work with, essentially, like this, you know. Here are the benchmarks for creature design or starship design and whatnot, and then I'll take those and make sure that they're applied correctly to the thing that I want, the weird ghost or, you know, the alien from the upside down planet or something like that.
All right, so you have numerous credits for both Pathfinder and Starfinder. What advice do you have for folks interested in becoming contributors to these?
Yeah, it's sort of a little bit like do what I did in that sense. Start by writing stuff for yourself so that you know that you can do it and that you can find your voice. Often you can sell that stuff right away if you've got... If the system you're writing for, or you're making one up yourself, but if the system you're writing for has a sort of an open game license situation, you can put your own imprint on that and you know, sell it as PDF. And that sort of helps to know that sort of when I'm looking for people that they're serious about what they want to do. Or you can just write for fun, write for your home game, write for something up for your own setting and try it out on your own players and see what they think. Write some stories, some fiction. Wayfinder is always a good place to submit to. Mm-hmm. They have a issue only once a year, but you know, it's still just get in there. And I mean, again, I sort of had contributed a couple things to that while I was basically trying to get my foot in the door here at Paizo, and I think it worked out great. I had a lot of fun, and it was fun to play in that sort of someone else's space for a little bit until I got to make it my own space. But then again, yeah, try look for, even if it's not Paizo, other companies out there are making stuff. There's so much stuff out there that you could probably write for. You can just sort of reach out to those creators, and then eventually, you know, you can reach out to us, send us a, you know, just an email, let us know what you've done. You know, the more the sort of more credits you have, the more I'm likely to sort of give you a good second look, to see if you're right for what I want for a particular project. Just keep going. If you don't get frustrated, if you don't get the thing right away. I think I had been in RPG Superstar for several years. I attempted to just do for fun and didn't mature, wasn't, you know, my knowledge of the rules and whatnot wasn't mature enough to get past the first stage until I got so far in it that I got hired.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the open a gaming license. Can you talk a little bit about that and how somebody would interact with that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. There are rules out there that you can look up. I don't know the full rules, but there is a certain thing. Is you just have to basically have this license. And again, I don't other products, other systems out there have a sort of similar Creative Commons situation. And you can always just, all you need to do is just look that up, and they'll tell you how to do that.
Right. It says right in there.
It says right in there. Exactly. You need to put this text in your product so that you can sell it as your own. And all of that, I think, is, I'm pretty sure, is available on our websites.
Yeah, so I guess what I'm looking at is kind of, so that you mentioned the Wayfinder, and if you write for the Wayfinder, you're able to actually interact with the Paizo setting.
That's true.
But with open gaming license, you can use the Starfinder rule set, but not interact with the setting.
Yes, right. certain basically proper nouns.
Right.
You wouldn't be able to use. That's how, the thing about Wayfinder is that you're giving your stuff away for free. Those magazines are free. So anything you do that is not you don't charge for, you can kind of
Under the open gaming license. Yeah. Right. That's
but once you want to charge for it, you have to use that open gaming license to say, like, oh, okay, we don't say, don't use capital D drift, it's called hyperspace. And that sort of thing. And it's just a sort of a way for Paizo to protect, you know, our intellectual property. But it's really easy to work around. And, you know, people have already come up with their own sort of fantastic settings that aren't anything.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of third-party publishers that kind of build upon it.
So. And, yeah, if you're looking for, like, oh, I don't know, I don't have my own setting, or I don't know what to write exactly, feel free to, you know, you should contact these third parties and see if they have openings for, like, hey, you know, we have this great, or a setting that you like Grimmer Space or something like that, which I'm sure is got its own long line of people wanting to contribute.
Right.
You can say, oh, we like this Dark Horror stuff, and try to see if they, you know, need someone to write a short adventure or a, you know, an archetype or something like that.
Yeah, I actually had an interview with Alex Agunas last week, and he has a third-party publisher, and he mentioned the process that he goes through, where if somebody brings something to him, he's willing to work with them on that and publish through his, or he can provide, basically hire them as freelancers to do things on his projects as well. So similar to what Paizo does at a smaller scale, obviously.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm going to caution against is basically don't try to sell something you've already written.
Yes.
That's a sort of common process with any of this, any of the creative, you know, stuff, is because we can't look at it at that point, because if for some reason we read it but we don't want to publish it at that point, it might get stuck in our subconscious, or just might just be happen to be parallel development of a same idea, and that just puts us into weird legal trouble.
So you're not looking for pitches for ideas. You're looking for just, hey, I'm interested. Yes. Here's my experience. Here's what I have published that you can look at to show that I can do this. Mm-hmm. But you don't want people to pitch an idea because you basically can't even look at it.
Essentially, yeah. And not right away, let's say that. What I like to see is people sort of saying, I like setting. I like creatures. I like the rules parts, this, that. Right. Sort of like an idea of generally what you like, so I know what I have for you. And then sometimes I'll be like, I don't know. I need a monster that's CR5 and is an elemental or something like that. What do you got? And then I'll directly ask you, like, give me some. What kind of monsters are you interested in writing, for instance? Mm-hmm. And then those are the pitches I will take and say yes, no, no.
When you solicit that pitch for that,
That makes it better. that keeps us out of that legal trouble.
Right. So this week, Paizo launched Starfinder for Alexa. Mm-hmm. How do you think this sort of AI-driven RPG play is going to change tabletop playing?
I don't know. Honestly, if I knew, I would have gotten in on it. No, it's going to be interesting. What I think it's going to do, it's going to help people get into the hobby a little more, a little quicker, a little easier. Mm-hmm. You can try this out and see what you feel like without having to sort of get a group together or find a organized play group that's running on your schedule. This is sort of makes it, I think I read someone tweeting that they're going to do this on their commute while they drive in. So, you know, it's something you can do at your leisure, like any sort of, like, pick up a book and read it or play a video game at any point when you're doing it, for the most part. So I think it's going to be, it's going to help help open up a bit of a floodgate. Because I am a GM, I personally have to say that, you know, at this point in time, you know, Alexa's not going to be replacing your GM.
Right.
It doesn't replace the experience of getting together with a group of your friends and hanging out and playing a game, even over virtual tabletop. That's its own, you know, that's a thing that I don't think this will replace just yet, because we don't have the technology, and when we do, we'll all be slaves to the machine overlords anyway. So we won't have time. We'll be too busy in the Silicon mines. But I think it's great. I mean, getting this sort of technology together, having cool voice acting, and getting to sort of direct this, how the story goes, is incredible. And I can't wait to see how it evolves and improves.
So right now it's the beginner box.
Yes, beginner box rule set,
right,
essentially.
Right. And so it seems like this is a nice kind of entryway, similar to the beginner box, but for a single person to understand and learn the rules and see if they like the setting, the interactions and stuff like that. But I agree. I GM a lot out here, and it's like, I don't see how, unless you have a very, very sophisticated, you know, Watson type of AI that can process an awful lot. And maybe Alexa can do that. I don't know. But it seems like it'd be a challenge to do that. And then you're still missing out on the other player interaction.
Yes.
Unless it becomes a multiplayer.
It very well could be in the future, right? I mean, we eventually went from single player video games to multiplayer online role playing games that kind of give you that's a different kind of experience. You kind of do have a computer being the GM there, but it's a very sort of fixed set of you can do this and do that. But the thing about tabletop role playing games, and you know, as a fellow GM, you know that the players can do some crazy stuff that you know, an AI can't quite probably won't be able to cope with just yet. So again, maybe we'll get some neural net processing going on and be able to sort of respond to silliness with silliness, like we're able to do as GMs. But until then, this is, again, sort of a good introductory, you get a feel for the setting, you get a feel for what you kind of do in Starfinder for the most part, can get your whistle wetted and go out there and get the beginner box, get the core rule book.
So do you know if there's a plan to expand beyond the beginner box of this, or is this a pilot just to see?
Right now we're just a pilot to see. Yeah. We are looking at some more stuff. I think the rule set will always be sort of the basic beginner box, because as a you know,
too many different flavors. Too many,
lots of different things in the normal core rule book that might be difficult for Alexa to sort of work through. But you know, we are looking to put out more content for sure.
Nice. So what's next for Jason? Kind of what's on your plate?
Sure, yeah. I am finishing up the Threefold Conspiracy AP. This was an AP sort of outlined and dreamt up by Chris Sims, who moved back to Europe recently. But it's all about conspiracies. It's got a real X-Files vibe. It's got a real mysteries vibe. It is... I can't say too much about it, because it's all about pulling the rug out from under the players. Every chance we get, playing with their perceptions and seeing in their alliances and who they can trust and who they can't trust. But that's ending up, will be ending up with AP number 30. Puppets Without Strings.
So it's a six book AP.
AP. It starts. I actually wrote the first volume, which is a sort of.
So it's going to be the best, obviously.
It's pretty damn good. It starts off with a sort of a Agatha Christie mystery on a, you know, Orient Express kind of you're on a starship and someone goes missing and what's going on and with all these people and everyone's got their own secrets and all that going on. And it ends up basically with the PCs trying to unmask some infiltrators through in the Pact World's government on Absalom Station.
It's like Scooby Doo unmask, or
a little bit. I mean, they may or may not be shape changers.
Okay.
Fully, just sort of like it gets up to the highest levels of that, and becomes a fight for the. For the heart and soul of the Pact World.
So a lot of intrigue, and not just
definitely a lot of intrigue. You're gonna find out
fighting and battles and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously always plenty of that, but this last volume definitely has a lot of wheeling and dealing of behind the scenes and just trying to figure out who's loyal to who and who has the best interest of the Pack Worlds at heart, and some people you might not expect are actually could be your best allies, and then some people who you think your allies are going to be your enemies.
So I'm going to guess probably paranormal investigator theme would might be useful for
the paranormal. Yeah, well, that was from
Signal Screams.
Signal Screams. Right. That was our sort of Ghostbusters-esque archetype. This is more of our sort of mystery, more Mulder and Scully archetype.
Well, you have some new themes, I'm guessing, though.
Do we have any new themes? Something I'm trying to remember from the first volume. What we do have is that article that is in the first volume, an article that I also wrote is sort of about running and playing in mysteries, right? Mm-hmm. And that actually doesn't have a new theme, but it does have a couple new sort of like feats you might want to take or spells you can use. And then that article also has a kind of like real fun player options on like espionage themed characters by Crystal Frazier. Mm-hmm. And it's got like gun kata fighting style.
A
ninja fighting style. Some stuff you can do with as a mechanic to like hide a weapon inside a keytar. So you just look like you're playing a musical instrument, but then you're shooting a laser beam at someone. Hiding your drone, making your drone look like a normal animal, mm-hmm. or all sorts of things. The operative obviously has a lot of sort of like espionage stuff. It's already got the spy specialization, but we're taking this out to some other classes like Envoy and Technomancer, that sort of thing. So that's pretty fun stuff that would also help you in this particular AP. And then we're going to have just a sort of a plethora of cryptid and weirder style monsters in our Alien Archives throughout. Mm-hmm.
So with Pathfinder, they have player companions, mm-hmm. that come out for the various APs. Is that something we might see? It sounds like there's something, like for this one, it might be good to have something like that.
We always try to, basically the back matter for our APs is our player companions, mm-hmm. at the moment. You can see that, second edition is sort of moving away from that sort of small player companion volume line. But, we don't have the resources currently, the workforce to sort of be able to put out as we have the resources to put out the books that we're putting out, and that's basically it. While those are hardbacks a few every year, and our APs, but our APs are where we try to put that extra player content in, so that as a GM, if you get the volume and you're reading another adventure, and this article can just be like printed up and given to your players if you want to, just say, hey, here's a bunch of stuff that works.
All right. So thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure. Appreciate it.
I look forward to seeing you again, maybe at PaizaCon.
I'll obviously be at PaizaCon.
Yeah. Are there any other conventions you attend around?
I am looking to go to the D8 Summit. I was invited, I should say, to go to the D8 Summit, which is in April in the Illinois area, I think. I'm pretty sure I'm going. I have to see basically how much I can get from Paizo in terms of per diems and whatnot.
So it becomes
whether or not it becomes an official visit or me just going. I have accepted the invitation to go. It's just because of how official it's going to be. And I'm always I'll probably be at Gen Con as well.
Right, as usual. Right. The big con.
The big one. Yeah. I'm trying to look to go to maybe one or two more cons.
Did you go to Origins this past year?
I did not go to Origins, no. But let me just say out there, if you've got a con and you want to invite me, please do. I'm happy to come out and run some Starfinder or do some talk on some panels, that sort of thing.
Excellent. Yes, for sure. I know of a couple cons looking to sign people up. There's a Conquest down in Sacramento in March, mm-hmm. that I think last year in their summer one, they brought Amanda and Rob McCreary down.
Yes, I remember
for the
that.
First
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
And so I think they'll be looking for folks. I'll mention to them that they should ask you.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.